Hey, good morning, everyone. My name is Frank. I'm the preacher here, and I'm just really delighted that you're hanging out with us today. I love it when I look up here and I see donation bags, because this says something about your generosity. You know, one of our core values, as Walter mentioned this morning, is others. We just want to be a blessing to other people. And another of our core values is generosity. And so when you give, not only are you helping us accomplish what we're trying to do as a church, but you look like Jesus when you give. So here's what I want you to do. I know that a lot of you have already participated. Some of you, maybe it's your first day here and you think, man, it's really cool. I'd love to be able to help a little kid have a brand new box of Crayolas, right? But you haven't been here, and so you didn't know about it until just today. Here's what I'd love for you to do. Go to Meijer today. By the way, Meijer is our corporate partner with this event. They provided 100 backpacks, $500 worth of backpacks. So I know Meijer's not here today, but let's hear it for Meijer. Thank you, Meijer. Here's what I'd love for you to do today. Go to Meijer and buy them out of school supplies. That's what I'd love for you to do. And when you walk in, you go clear to the far right-hand side of the store over by the pharmacy. You'll see all their school supplies. They've got crayons for 50 cents a box, limit 10. So I want you to go in, buy 10, leave, go put them in the car, go back in, buy 10, leave, go put them in the car, all right? But seriously, here's what I would love for you to do. I don't know what lane is open and what lane isn't open at Meijer, because I haven't been there yet today, but here's what I'd love for you to do. When you go to get your school supplies today, now you're going to go today, you're going to buy some school supplies, go to the nearest lane that has a human in it, right? In other words, don't just go to the quick check it out thing, bloop, 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 and, pay and leave. I would love for, say, 20 or 30 people from South to all go to the nearest lane where there's a checkout person and have that person wonder, why are there 20 people all walking through here with their limit of crayons and glue, right? Because at some point that person is going to be like, what's going on? And you're going to have the opportunity to tell them, there's just a bunch of us here trying to look like Jesus. And today, Jesus is buying crayons. So I'd love for you to do that. You can get those. You can bring them back to us by Tuesday, and that'd be great. We're going to pass them all out on Saturday. We need your help with that, too, by the way, 11 to 2. That's going to be amazing as we stock all these little kids up with school supplies. So you can follow along today in our teaching. I would love for you to do that. If you have your mobile phone or iPad, you can go to YouVersion and follow along in the live event, or you can just download our app. We have our app available at the Google Play Store and at the Apple Store, so you can download our app and you can follow along with the teaching. So we're in week 3 of a series that we're calling the Red Sea Rules, and it's based on this tiny little book by Robert Morgan. And if you haven't picked that up, you can today. It's $6. It's out in the lobby. If you're here for the first time today, by the way, I'm just going to give you a copy. We'd love for you just to have a copy as our gift to you. Stop by the big display out there, the Summer Strong display, and tell them, hey, Frank said he'd give me a copy. And we'll give you a copy so you can follow along. We all want to pass along to our kids desirable traits, right? We want our kids to inherit from us good things. But the reality is that they don't just inherit good things from us. They sometimes inherit things that are less than desirable. In my family, one of the traits that my kids got from me, all three of them, by the way, they got from me is really, really bad eyesight. Really bad eyesight. No more than, in fact, the worst of my three kids is my middle child, my son Caleb. And if any of you know about myopia, his prescription is minus 12.5, right? Which is really bad. And we first found out that he had this problem when he was like 2 years old and we're driving down the road. He looked out the window at a tree and he said, cow? And so we thought, well, this is a problem. So we started watching him. We'd put his food down in front of him at dinner. If this is his dinner plate, he'd do this. We're like, man, that little guy can't see anything. So we took him to the doctor, and we got him glasses, and he had the cutest little glasses. I'm going to show them to you today. He was like 3 when we took this picture. Yeah, that's him. He's not as cute as that anymore, but but I'm resisting the urge to make a joke about blonde chicks right now, so I'm not going to do that. But he's still a great kid, and he still has really bad eyesight. So, that, like I said, they get it from me. I struggle with vision, too. So I go to the eye doctor recently. I do the yearly eye doctor checkup thing. I go to the eye doctor, and she says to me, Frank, it's time for you to get bifocals. I wanted to say, no, it's time for me to get a new eye doctor. Because bifocals are for old people, right? And I'm still young. I'm only 48. And I'm serious, like, bifocals? Are you kidding me? Some of you probably like me, like you go to read, you know, you get the mail and you find yourself playing the trombone, right? You're trying to see what it says. And so I'm not going to get bifocals because I'm just not. And I wear contact lenses. And so she said, well, we can fix you up with this special contact lens thing called monovision. Now, monovision sounds better to me than bifocal. Doesn't it sound better to you? Monovision. How many of you have monovision contacts? Raise your hand if you have monovision contacts. 1, 2, 3. Yeah? Well, I understand why y'all three of you are sitting in the back, right? Because here's the deal with monovision lenses. They have one lens that is your prescription for far away. In my instance, it's my left eye, so I can see things far away with my left eye. And then another prescription for things that are up close. In my case, it's my right eye. And so I've got this one eye that's able to look out there, and I got this other eye that's able to look right here. And she said, now, don't worry. Your brain will get used to it. So she puts me in these, and she says, she's, you know, the little test thing, and then you go in the little room, right? And she says, what do you think? I said, looks great. She says, here's the bill. I said, you got to be kidding me. And so for like 2 weeks, I'm walking around looking like Popeye. You can't decide which eye to put his patch on. You know, it was just crazy. And so there's this huge adjustment. Now, my brain has gotten used to it. My optic nerve, I don't know how this works. Some of you who are smarter than me, I know we got some doctors in here. You can probably explain it. But my brain figures out the signals that my optic nerve is sending to it. And now I can actually drive and not hurt anybody. And so it's been an adjustment, but I'm figuring out how to do it. Now, here's the question I have for you. What about you? Do you have trouble focusing? Do you have trouble focusing? Here's the thing. I think that if you've ever experienced a time of intense stress or pressure or difficulty, you know what it means to struggle to focus. Maybe for you it's a financial catastrophe, some kind of a financial meltdown. You lost a job, you lost a house, you had a financial reversal, your portfolio went in the tank, and what dominated your field of vision was your money, your finances. And you had trouble focusing literally on anything else because your income was just so radically affected. Maybe for you, though, maybe it's not the money thing. Maybe for you, it's you're sitting on the sidelines and you're watching someone that you care about go through a health crisis, or maybe you personally are experiencing a health crisis. And so that, whatever that is, it dominates your field of vision. It's right here. You can't see around it. You can't focus on anything else. And if you had monovision and you had one lens that was focused, you know, at the distance, it wouldn't matter because everything's right up close. And this is all you can see. You can't focus on anything else. Or maybe you're a student. We have a lot of students here, both at Michigan State, LCC, Great Lakes Christian College. Maybe you're a student and you've gotten yourself in a little bit deeper than you intended. You know, your advisor said, take 15 hours, but you said, well, no, I'm going to take 18 hours and try and get done with college faster. Or maybe you took that class that the title looked really, really simple, but then you got in the class and you found out, I have no idea what I'm doing. And you read the textbook and, you know, you know what the words mean. Right? But when you put the words all together into sentences and paragraphs, you're like, I have no idea what that author's trying to say. But the problem is you've gotten past the drop add date where you can drop a class or add a class. You passed that. Now you're in, you're committed, you're all in, but you're freaking out because your GPA is going to tank. You know it is. You're struggling. And that class, that paper, that project, that assignment, that midterm, that final is the only thing you can see. It's the only thing you can focus on. And everything else seems to fade or blur into obscurity because that's where your focus is. Now, those are all bad. Money problems, job problems, school problems, relationship problems, those things are all bad. They're difficult. They're tough. They take your focus, you know, away from other things. But what about those times when the opposition in your life is more spiritual in nature? What about those times when the thing that you're struggling with is some sort of satanic or demonic attack? Maybe it's for you, it's a temptation that you've been dealing with. You've been trying to resist that temptation. You've been fighting it. You've been fighting that urge, but you've wrestled with it. But for you, it is taking up all of your energy and all of your focus. You're focused on that thing that you know God doesn't want you to do, and you want to pursue holiness, but you're really struggling, and the devil's right at your heels, and he's trying to snare you with this temptation, and so you can't focus on anything else. You want to remain pure. You want to do the right thing. You want to focus on God, but instead, looming large in your life is this sin issue or temptation issue or this spiritual battle that captures all of your focus. When the Israelites were caught between the sword and the sea, they had trouble focusing too. We've been the last 3 weeks in this series called the Red Sea Rules. And you know what it's all about? The ancient Israelites, how they were slaves in Egypt for 400 years. And God sent Moses, and Moses said, "The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has sent me to bring you to deliverance. God is going to lead you out of slavery. He's going to lead you out of captivity in Egypt and into a land that is flowing with milk and honey, a homeland of your very own. God is going to deliver you." And through this miraculous series of events, 10 plagues that God sent to Egypt, the Israelites were given their freedom and indeed were urged to leave Egypt. Go, be gone, get out, go somewhere else. And so God took them, led them out of Egypt and east toward Israel. But then God gave them a little navigational adjustment. And God put them in a place that was geographically indefensible. God put them, he had them make a hard turn, and he put them between a sea on one side, and the advancing army of the king of Egypt on the others. And it was when they were in this place, caught between the sword and the sea, that they had to really decide what their faith was all about. And hence, these 10 Red Sea rules that you and I can apply to our lives when we find ourselves caught between a rock and a hard place. We learned a couple weeks ago about Red Sea rule number one. Red Sea rule number one is simply this: realize that God has intentionally placed you where you are. God wants you where you're at. Whether he wants to teach you something, whether he wants to glorify himself through your deliverance, God has put you where you are. God means for you to be there. Last week, we learned Red Sea rule number two, and that is simply this: when you find yourself in a tough spot, you and I, we need to be more concerned for God's glory than we are for our own relief. Too often we try to draw the straightest line between where we're at, the tough spot that we're in, and where we want to be, the freedom or the relief. We focus on relief. Instead, Red Sea rule number two says, let's focus on God's glory. What would happen if we would say, God, we want you to be glorified in this situation, instead of immediately going to the God, get me out of this mess prayer that we often pray? This week's Red Sea rule, it's all about your focus. It's all about where your eyes are directed. Red Sea rule number three is simply this: acknowledge your enemy, but keep your eyes on the Lord. When you're in a tough spot, when you're between the sword and the sea, when the Pharaoh's army is approaching and you've got your backs to the ocean, acknowledge the enemy, but keep your eyes on the Lord. If you got your Bible, we're in Exodus chapter 14 again this week. You can click there with your phone, mobile device. You can follow along on YouVersion or using our app. Exodus chapter 14, verse 5. When word reached the king of Egypt that the Israelites had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds. "What have we done, letting all those Israelite slaves get away?" they asked. So Pharaoh harnessed his chariot and called up his troops. He took with him, this is important now, he took with him 600 of Egypt's best chariots, along with the rest of the chariots of Egypt, each with its commander. I watched a documentary this week. Took me about 2 days. But I watched this documentary this week that was all about Egyptian chariots. I know I need to get a life. It's on PBS. PBS is that station, you know, where they play the old songs and ask you for money. And so they had this documentary on Nova about these two American professors who went to Egypt, and they're trying to reconstruct an ancient chariot. And we're able to do this. We can do this because when they opened King Tut's tomb years and years and years ago, they found an actual chariot. They found King Tut's chariot in the tomb. And they reassembled it, and you can go now to the ancient the Museum of Antiquities in Cairo, and you can actually see King Tut's tomb. And so these two professors decided they were going to try and reconstruct an Egyptian chariot. Now, here's what we know. Here's what we're able to learn about Egyptian chariots. Number one, they were technologically superior to any other war machine that was extant at that time. It was, you know, like the Sherman tank of their day, right? Technologically superior in every way. They were incredibly light and fast. In fact, an Egyptian chariot, two people could pick it up and carry it. Incredibly light. And because they were so light, they were incredibly fast. They actually had shock absorption built into them so that they could go over rough terrain or uneven terrain and absorb the shock instead of all of that being transferred into the driver and the soldier, which there were two, by the way. There was a driver and a soldier in every chariot. The soldier was generally equipped with a bow, and the driver would charge toward the other battle line, the enemy battle line, while the archer would fire his arrows into that battle line, and then the charioteer would wheel and race backward before the enemy could retaliate. Their wheels actually had six spokes, which the other nations at the time either had four, in which case the wheels would break, or they would have eight, in which case the wheels were too heavy. But the Egyptians had figured out a way to make a chariot with six spokes that was technologically superior. Now, here's the thing. The force that Pharaoh assembled to pursue the Israelites included his own guard, his own led the elite group of charioteers that he himself led, and there were 600 of those. And so the Exodus account says that not only did Pharaoh take his 600 best charioteers, the ones that were sort of his parade group, you know, the king's very own guard, he took them, but he also took every other chariot and charioteer in his army. And with all of them, he pursued the Israelites. Some estimates say there may have been as many as 1 to 2 million of these former slaves. And so Pharaoh mustered his entire army to go after them. It was the largest, most fearsome war machine at that time on planet Earth. And they were bearing down on the Israelites. Verse 8 says this: "The Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, so he chased after the people of Israel who had left with fists raised in defiance." Another translation said, "who had marched out boldly from Egypt."